This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm with consultant child and adolescent psychiatrist Dr. Anand Bentoven, founder of the Child and Family Practice in London. Dr. Bentoven will be speaking at the Jack Tizard Memorial Lecture and National Conference that ACAM, the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, is holding in June, which focuses on helping young people in crisis.
Can you start by introducing yourself?
Yes. So, I'm Anand Bentoven, and I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist, and I've been in the field quite a long time, because I qualified literally the same year that the ACAMH was founded, and I began my child and adolescent psychiatric training at the Maudsley a few years later, and became a member of this association at that time, because it was the association to be a member of if you were interested in this field. Although I trained at the Maudsley, I was interested in dynamic approaches, so I then moved to Great Ormond Street, which was rather more dynamic in its orientation, started an analytic training, which was what child and adolescent psychiatrists did in those days. But in the 60s, I soon got caught up in the family therapy revolution, and together with colleagues in London founded the Association for Family Therapy and the Institute of Family Therapy. So I was continuing with these two streams, my analytic work and the systemic ideas, try to keep them both going. And then when I was appointed at Great Ormond Street in 1968, being a newly appointed consultant, I was asked, would I become part of the newly formed Child Protection Group? Because because in the light of Henry Kemp's well-known paper on the battered child syndrome at the hospital at Great Ormond Street, it was felt we should be aware and involved. And so I began, in parallel to my work with analytic and family systemic thinking, to become involved in the child protection field. And we established a number of services at Great Ormond Street over the years. We formed a Trauma X unit, which was a sub-unit that was concerned about looking at and being aware of children admitted to the hospital, where there was clear that there had been evidence of abuse, and we were involved in a number of interesting developments, particularly that of Munchausen by proxy and seeing children and young people who'd been induced into illness states in the hospital. And in parallel, we also began services in our department for children and families, where to just really begin to develop a treatment approach for children and families where they'd been identified as abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse. And then in the 70s, we became involved in assessment of children who'd been sexually abused. And we started running a therapeutic, probably the first therapeutic service in Europe, actually, for working with different groups of children, young children, older children, adolescents who'd been sexually abused. Together with Eileen Vizard, we began work with young people who were offending, and then also working with parents and parent groups, and working with adults, particularly where they had abused children, so we could actually begin the therapeutic work with them and begin to look at whether the sort of family systemic ideas could move towards some sort of resolution of abusive experiences and abusive actions. So we published a number of papers on that, and then got involved with research on trying to understand the origins of sexually harmful behaviour. So that really took me through my career at Great Ormond Street, with the development of a service to look at complex situations to help the courts make decisions when children had been harmed, whether there was a prospect of them returning home, whether they needed alternative care. So we got very much involved in that whole field.
Can I ask what prompted your interest in the first place?
Well, interestingly, it was when I was doing my medical school training, I got very interested in paediatrics. Mm-hmm. And when I did a paediatrics house job at St Thomas's, I began to see the way in which children's health states fluctuated so markedly in the presence of family members, and began to see the family interactive aspects to do with child health. So that in a sense, that propelled me towards mental health, and also then to decide to specialise in child and adolescent mental health, which at that time, in the early 60s, was very much a new area. Mike Rutter had just been appointed at the Maudsley, and I worked on his team in part. So it was very much that time.
Since infancy. You founded the Child and Family Practice with your wife, Marianne. Can you say a little bit about the types of cases that you handle within your practice?
Sure. Well, I retired after my almost 30 years in the hospital in 1994, and decided, because I had always done some independent practice, both in terms of court assessments and also working with children and families, and I decided that I didn't want to go into solitary splendour in a consulting room in Harley Street. So instead of that, we decided that we would found an independent practice, and that has really that's really grown very significantly, and it's now in Bloomsbury and has about 40 or 50 independent practitioners working. And we tried to establish a team, a multidisciplinary team, because London is such a major centre for health and for families and children and families. We established a service with paediatricians, neurologists, psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists, to try to offer an independent service. And that, and more recently, although I've now no longer practicing there, they've established a charitable foundation to try to ensure that children and families can be offered therapeutic work in the independent sector.
Right. And there's a child and family training component. Can you tell me a little bit about the training aspect?
Yes. Well, in 2000, the Department for Health, subsequently Department for Education, got very interested in establishing the assessment framework for children in need and their families, which I consulted to. And that was an approach which tried to ensure that children within the welfare service and related services would have a holistic approach. In other words, their parenting would be assessed, the needs of the children, the family and community factors, the triangle. And so myself and Professor Tony Cox from Guy's, we were commissioned with colleagues to develop a series of evidence-based approaches to help practitioners across the field carry out evidence-based assessments for children, parents and families. And we then established child and family training together with other colleagues to train those approaches which we had developed. And so we developed approaches to working based on the research we did at Great Ormond Street and the Institute of Child Health on family assessment. We introduced a training in family assessment. We also included, and we were funded to produce a set of video training material, which I'm going to be using in my presentation, to work to make assessments of the environment of care, the home environment of care. And then we developed a framework for safeguarding assessment when there were complex court cases, based on the work that we did. And the most recent development has been the intervention resources, which I'm going to be speaking about in my presentation.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about interventions for preventing harm from adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs. And the research seems to suggest that interventions are often too reliant on one modality or other, so for example CBT or a psychodynamic approach. Also that children affected by several ACEs or those with comorbidities are not always well served. Is that, have I understood that correctly?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. I mean, we're very concerned about the phenomenon of polyvictimization. Mm-hmm. Work by David Finkelmore and his colleagues in the States, which demonstrated that that a significant number of children were affected by more than one form of harmful abuse. They were sexually abused and rejected, and also there may be physical abuse and other forms of abuse, and that the more of these different forms of abuse the child and young person experienced, the more likely they were to show extreme harm. And of course, in teenage life, around the age of 14, to flip into aggressive, harming others as a response to experiences of abuse and an externalizing approach. The sort of approach that we notice in our research on trying to understand the origins of children who displayed harmful sexual behavior. So, with this interest in polyvictimization, multiple forms of abuse, of course, you link that to the fact of interest in adverse childhood experiences, which adds to the basic forms of abuse, physical, emotional, sexual, neglect, exposure to violence, other harmful experiences, such as having a parent who's got serious mental health problems or substance abuse or has been incarcerated. And to those have been added extreme bullying, peer victimization, or being put in situations of extreme community stress, having to care for a parent who has been abused, a parent who has mental health problems. So it was evident that we're faced with this very significant set of harmful influences, which of course, the more harmful influences, the more the extreme effect on the child and young person. And it's interesting that this research has been from the States, has been confirmed here by a group, Cecil and colleagues, and that have worked working actually with the Kids Company children, noting that when they did a survey of a large number of children, how many of the children experienced more than one form of harmful experience, and the more harmful experiences, the more significant the impact. So, faced with that, given that I've always been interested in trying to bring treatment approaches together. I mean, I wrote a paper years ago together with a colleague, Warren Kinston, on linking psychodynamic and systemic approaches in the family therapy field. And I came across this paper by Bruce Chorpita and Eric DeLeiden, which talked about common elements approach, which actually said, look, we have over 1,000 different interventions in the child mental health field to help children and families who, and though that in fact many of these different approaches, whether they're psychodynamic or CBT or systemic, do the same actions, the same therapeutic ways of working. The common one, which I think everybody is aware of, is the notion of a trauma narrative, an account of a traumatic experience. And many different approaches say that that's helpful, from the dynamic approach, the trauma-focused cognitive CBT. And so that's a common element.
Right.
And so they did this research across the whole field of child and adolescent mental health and produced a whole set of common elements. And we thought, and I thought, wow, that's an interesting approach. And so we've been able to work with that group at UCLA to look at the whole range of interventions for child abuse, and there are up to 64 different studies, and we looked at about 30 of them. And with the help of Chorpita and Delaiden and colleagues, we were able to establish the common elements to actually work to prevent child and adolescent maltreatment, and to actually help children recover from those experiences and help parents modify their responses. And so we've now added the way in which that approach, which we call Hope for Children and Families Intervention Resources, to target the broader field of ACEs as well. And we've produced a whole set of guides. Here's a guide, Modifying Abusive and Neglectful Parenting, which gives a step-by-step approach to a number of modules for practitioners across the field to actually help parents modify harmful responses. Or here's another one, working with children, young people addressing emotional and traumatic responses, and that's another approach. So they, each of them, have the collective wisdom of myself and colleagues that put them together based on these common elements, and that's the sort of approach which we've been developing. So even though it's many years since my original dynamic and systemic approaches, to work with an approach which brings so much together has been very interesting and very, very helpful. And we feel that there's a tremendous scope to use that approach in our field for the many practitioners who need to develop skills to work with children and families. And we've done a series of piloting with different parts of the country, which have proven to be, people have found it helpful. We've trained people in different authorities, cohort training with groups of social workers, with health professionals. It's been translated, and we've worked in other countries, and they found it helpful. There is a need for more detailed research to demonstrate the effectiveness in different contexts, which we're very keen to promote. But so far, the response, and this is the second edition of these these nine guides, response has been very positive, and people find them easy to access with lots of help of how to deliver an evidence-based approach. So far, so good.
So this idea of having mental health leads in schools, some of the recent green paper, Transforming Mental Health Services, that's something you support, is it?
Yes. I feel that one of the powerful benefits of the modular approach, which we're obviously very interested in developing, is that it can provide skills for practitioners at all levels. And in our piloting, the people who found it most helpful, because it gave steps to carry out an intervention, were those who were very experienced, knew children well, had worked with them, but never had a training or never had a qualification, but could use these approaches. And I think the notion of having an approach which can be utilized as resources by practitioners at all levels, of course, when in the child and adolescent mental health field, when we have children with highly complex disorders, they're going to need the most specialist help. But it would make a tremendous difference if more practitioners had more skills, so that in a sense there could be early intervention. And it's interesting that the government is currently very interested in a national early intervention process, approach to deal with adversity. And having a broad range of intervention resources could be a helpful way of achieving that goal.
When looking to safeguard children who are living with trauma and family violence, what are the key considerations in ensuring that one does right by the child?
Well, the model which we've developed at Child and Family Training is an approach which I think is helpful, could be helpful, because we feel that there's a 7 stages that people need to be aware of, because the first stage is recognizing there is a problem, mm-hmm. that a child might be being harmed, might need protecting, might need safety. But the second stage is to carry out a broad-based, holistic assessment of the child and the family, to understand, using our triangle, what are the factors in parenting, what are the strengths, what are the difficulties, what are the factors in the parent which might be played out in relationship to the children, what are the needs of the children across their health, across nutrition, across their well-being, across emotional health, across attachments, what are the needs of the children, and then to be able to analyse and see the patterns and make a prediction of what's going to happen here, what are the strengths that might help the child, what are the difficulties that's going to mean that problems are going to escalate, so that we can actually say, well, what's the likelihood of continuing harm here, what's the potential to help the family, where are the strengths that we need to build on, where are the difficulties that we need to target, and then what are the resources we need to do that. And I think that's the general approach we need to take, in other words, to make it, to look at, to assess, to bring information together, to analyse it, to make a prediction of what's going to happen, and then either say, this is a family where there's such severity of abuse, where there's such intransigence, where there's such problems of the parental mental health or personality disorders, that it's unlikely we're going to help those parents in the child's time frame. Mm-hmm. I used to have, when I went to court, I used to have one, something I would often say to the judges, look, I appreciate the parents, I really want to help their children. They really have an intention to deal with their problems of addiction or their problems of mental health or their problems of poor caring capacities. But the mountain's too high to climb. And I think in this instance, the child really needs alternative care.
One of your research projects in collaboration with the Institute of Child Health is longitudinal research on factors associated with the development of sexually abusive behaviour in young people. Can you share some of the findings from...
Yes. These projects often start in a rather serendipitous way. When we started our sexual abuse project at the hospital, I can't quite remember why, but we kept all the files in a set of filing cabinets in one of the in our department, so we actually had all the notes that we ever of the children. So we thought, well, might be a good idea to look at the boys who were that we'd seen for treatment, and there may be 3-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds who've been abused. Obviously, a smaller proportion of boys are abused than girls, but boys are more responsible for sexually harmful behaviour, but not exclusively. So we actually followed those boys up in towards their adult life and used ways of looking through the courts or looking through social services to track what had happened to them.
What was the time?
Oh, yeah. About 10, 15 years, right. Something like that. So they were teenagers or young adults at the time. And I don't know whether we'd be able to do it now, but we were able to. Then we got permission. And we looked at what were the factors at the time in their childhood that seemed to have an influence about which direction they would go. We would have hoped that maybe our treatment might have made a difference, but that was because it wasn't designed in that sort of way. That was more difficult to tell. But what was interesting, it was those boys who, as well as being sexually abused, had also been exposed to violence to harmful responses towards their mothers, towards women, females perhaps, important point, had been neglected and rejected. In other words, these were boys who had been subject to multiple ACEs, and those, or polyvictimization, and those are the boys who were more likely to externalize and to demonstrate harmful responses. And it was interesting because we found, we were able to locate a number of the young people and found, and those who were at high risk, some of them had indicated that they had behaved in a sexually harmful way, although it had never been identified. But that boys who had been sexually abused did not have this whole network of other adversity, were much less likely to behave abusively in later life. So that was an interesting and important study.
I want to look at some of the interventions that appear to be successful with young people with a history of offending behaviour.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if the disruptive, innovative approach that you described earlier, is that something that's shown to be effective?
Yes, and the modular approach which we've developed, which is a disruptive innovative approach, one of the guides which we developed together with my colleagues at the Faithful Foundation, and one of the tasks I've been chair of the trustees at the Lucy Faithful Foundation, which is an organisation which is concerned to work protect children by ensuring that individuals who have offended have appropriate intervention. And so together with the Faithful Foundation and Hilary Eldridge, we actually did the research which included looking for the common elements that that were utilised in work with young people who'd offended. And one of our guides, which focuses on child sexual abuse, has work both with children who've been abused and also children and adolescents who've been responsible for sexually harmful behaviour. So we have utilised the modular approach to work with those children and young people now, and that's been a very interesting development.
And how widespread is the use of the modular approach?
Well, it's in recent years we've done a total re-edit in light of the piloting and the work we've done, and many people have been interested to purchase, and some training has arisen from that, because we've taken the view that the guides, that a practitioner could train themselves, because it has the steps, it has the scripts, it has the worksheets, but that training is even better.
Right.
And many people have purchased, and particularly a great deal of interest in working with emotional and traumatic responses, as well as positive parenting.
Right.
In other words, how can I deal with challenging behaviour? So beginning to be interested, and then training in some of the guides, and then more general training.
You're working to integrate common treatment elements and procedures into a coordinated framework. I think you touched upon this earlier. Can you say more about this?
I think that the way in which we're looking at it now is to say that we need to take an area, for example, interventions following abuse and neglect, or interventions for looked after children who are in local authority care or foster care, interventions for children who've been exposed to domestic violence, interventions for sexual abuse, interventions for ACEs. So what we've done is to take these particular practice areas and say, so what's the basic thinking about how to approach the work there, and then how can we fit the sort of modules which we've developed and integrate it into a training that's going to help practitioners work with those sorts of problems, so that it may well be that if we're working with foster carers for the care of children who may have been abused in their previous care, that those foster carers and those supporting them are going to need help, particularly positive parenting, because they're going to behave in a challenging way, and they need to systematically find ways to praise, to reward, to manage challenging behaviour. They're also going to need help specifically about dealing with disruptive behaviour and working with children and young people to, we have a notion of finding a new life, helping young people behaving in a challenging way by creating a different mindset about their futures and helping them manage their own anger and aggression as well as the parent. Or if there's anxiety, if there's traumatic responses, to help build trauma narratives. So what we're trying to do is to say which of the modules are going to be particularly relevant for this particular piece of work. And then we've also looked at children with basic mental health problems, anxiety, depression, trauma, conduct, because we have the match built into our approach. Then we can work out, well, which modules would it be helpful to work with anxiety, children or anxiety, who are both anxious and depressed and showing some challenging behaviour. In other words, the comorbid problems in everyday mental health practice.
You're presenting at the Jack Tizard Memorial Lecture and National Conference in June. It feels pertinent to mention that you worked with Jack Tizard. Can you please say a little bit about...
Yes. Well, one of the great experiences for me as a trainee was to be an interviewer on the famous Isle of Wight study, epidemiological study, which Jack carried out with Michael Rutter and Philip Graham, Kingsley Whitmore. And I visited the island on 2-3 occasions to carry out interviews. And of course, Jack and Mike and Philip and so on were there. So it was a great pleasure to have that interchange with them whilst we were doing our assessments.
You've probably covered some of this already, but can you give a sort of brief summary of some of the areas that you plan to address during your talk at the National Conference?
Yes, well, I want to emphasise that complexity and multiple problems are the rule rather than the exception. Mm-hmm. I want to demonstrate the way in which these experiences have a transdiagnostic effect on children and young people's mental health. And I want to talk about the way in which a modular approach could be a helpful solution to deal with complexity because of the focus both on the parent, the child, and the family. And then to use one of our case one of our video case examples just to demonstrate briefly what I mean and how it would work. So that's what I hope to cover.
Anon, thank you ever so much. Dr. Anon Bentoven will be speaking at the Jack Tizard Memorial Lecture and ACAM National Conference, Helping Young People in Crisis, Gender Identity, Personality Problems and Complex Trauma, which takes place in London on June the 14th. More information is available on the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.